The year is 1994, and Mike Nichols surprised critics and audiences with his neo-satirical take on the werewolf story, in which Jack Nicholson plays a mild-mannered book editor who faces a crossroads in his life with his career, his marriage, and his self-respect. However, all that changes one dark night when he is bitten by a wolf after hitting it with his car. Things begin to change for him as his senses heighten and his appetite for violence and machismo begin to turn his life around. When the daughter of his new boss enters his life, first as a curiosity, then as an obsession, he begins to face the challenge of whether to live his fullest potential as a man or regress to his purest animal urges in the maligned cult classic, Wolf. Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony. Okay, so 1994, I was 13 years old. I saw this with my mom in the theater. And I gotta tell you, man, being a preteen, tween, teenager for this movie isn't that bad because it almost plays like a young adult novel, but with middle-aged characters. It's a very interesting take on the werewolf story. It has enough of the supernatural function to it, but it also talks a lot about, like, you know, midlife crisis and human stuff. But the melodrama is very teen, young adult, almost soap opera. And that's what makes this film such a conundrum to me, because when you think about Mike Nichols, one of our greatest directors, one of our greatest storytellers, and the cast that we have in this movie, it doesn't feel like it has the prestige of that. It almost feels like a practical joke. And a lot of critics felt that way about it. A lot of audience members felt that way about it. But personally, for me, I like the joke. I like the fact that it doesn't feel traditional Hollywood. I like the fact that the melodrama is so thick that at the end of the day, we really don't know what to make of this movie. And you know me, I love a challenge, and that's how this movie challenges me. What about you?
I've always loved this movie, and I think I was, what, 12 at the time, maybe, I think it was. And even with the concept of the wolf, the monster movie theme, the romance never outweighs the monster. The monster never outweighs the romance. It's a perfect balance. Mm-hmm. So it's enough for an adolescent to really grab hold of this. And even when we get to where we are now, especially with the rewatches, this still did get my attention, and it did bring me back to the 1940s with the music, with Ennio Morricone, and a lot of this melodramatic stuff that really intertwines the romance and the fear of transformation. And there's a lot of themes that we can take from this movie of interpretation that does really dangle the carrot in front of the viewers that I think is also a piqued interest when it comes to watching this movie. So I've always been a fan, and I'm not even talking about the performances yet. I'm just talking about the temptation of where this movie is and how smart it is.
It's almost like there's a pseudo David Lynchian vibe to it, right? Where we don't feel like we're existing in a reality. It's a heightened reality. It's almost surrealistic reality, but it never feels overtly creepy. Like, you don't feel like you're in danger with this movie. And I think that's what makes it accessible. Like when I said, as a teenager, I thought it was perfect for me, and that's why. Now, what's interesting is go back and watch the trailer. The trailer plays it like it's a horror movie, right? The trailer plays it, it's like a Wolfman movie. There's going to be kills. There's going to be blood. There's going to be very dramatic moments. And then, like I said, it comes out to be almost very Lynchian. It's a conundrum, and I like it. Now, it's funny to go back and think about when I remember hearing people talk about this movie, other critics, they didn't like that. Like, they were expecting either a full-on horror movie or a full-on romance movie, you know? Like, oh, these two can't be together because he's a wolf and she's in danger. But that's not what it's about. it's very deceiving. The concept, the trailer, everything that is perceived about this movie is really not what the movie is about at all. In a way, it does kind of deal with the midlife crisis that Jack Nicholson is going through, his career in shambles, his pride in shambles, his marriage in shambles, the young upstart who's kind of going around behind his back, taking control of his life and his job. Like, that is kind of the main focal point of the story, and the wolf and the transformation and the aggression is a metaphor for someone almost like recapturing their machismo and their confidence and their pride. In a way, it actually seems to work and be more relevant with today's climate when you think about like the red pill mentality and people saying, oh, just because you're in your 40s or 50s and you're getting soft doesn't mean your life as a man is over. You can still be tough. You can still be aggressive. Go to the gym. Put all your life into your work. That's kind of what this movie is about, but it does it, like I said, with a very melodramatic tone. And I'm still kind of baffled by the idea that Mike Nichols directed this, because it feels so different than everything he's done.
It feels so different. And I think what I really gathered during my rewatch, and over the years, I've watched this numerous times, and I can try and pick themes and different messaging pieces of it, of interpretation of how, what am I going to take from this? And when we look at Mike Nichols and his direction style, this one almost feels like a cry for a midlife crisis. This almost feels like a cry of a male fantasy, especially with the editing that I'll get into later that I absolutely hated. But to me, when it comes to Mike Nichols' direction, it makes sense of that male fantasy where we have the faded cut scenes and we have the music that just kind of fades out. So there's a lot to this direction that I think is really interesting when it comes to a Mike Nichols movie that separates this from anything else he does. It brought me back to 1943's Phantom of the Opera by, oh God, Arthur Lubins, I think it was, where we do really have this dreamlike fantasy, but it was more targeted to the damsel in distress. But we don't get that here because we're in a time in the 90s where we have a big empowerment of the female leads doing something different in movie roles. And we see that with Michelle Pfeiffer, where we don't get that stereotypical character here.
To ride on top of that point, not only is it an unexpected werewolf movie, it's an unexpected performance from Jack Nicholson. I mean, this is a moment in the 90s where he was like in his prime, most characterized version of himself, right? The same with Al Pacino. The 90s until like the 2010s, we knew what a Jack Nicholson movie and a performance was, just as we knew what an Al Pacino performance was going to be. It was this point where they just found themselves, and that is what they did in every film. And then you go and watch this movie where it's like, oh, he is not playing himself at all. He is actually taking a wide step away from that confidence and machismo that we're used to him seeing. He plays almost a broken man. I'm not saying effeminate, but he's definitely a man who no longer has the drive emotionally, physically, with work ethic or anything like that. It's like he is letting the world just kind of beat him down. Any actor that we like could think of in that particular era could have played that and really not been anything outstanding or outlandish, because that is a very commonly played character. But when you put a person like Jack Nicholson in that role, now you're looking at like a real, like I said, step backwards from what this guy normally does. And it seems like a miscast at first, but as he begins to get the confidence back and become the Jack Nicholson that we know, it's almost like they're dangling the carrot in front of you. It's like, who is this guy? This isn't my Jack. And as he slowly gets more aggressive with this wolf spirit, he becomes the Jack. It's a very great way of manipulating your audience into giving you the person that you want him to be. And I think that's brilliant in its writing and its directing and its performance.
It is absolutely brilliant. And I know this was a passion project for Nicholson for like a decade.
Right.
But here's what I loved about the performance of Nicholson, and it almost complements Pfeiffer's performance, is we don't get that stereotypical drastic change where I'm human, then I'm animal, and there's going to be nothing in between. Here we get that subtle Nicholson performance where it gradually almost cherry picks personality traits as he turns into this animal, where it is that dreamlike state, but we still see Nicholson present. And I think the when it comes to Nichols' direction on how he wanted this character to be, that's where we see a lack of the makeup, because we still wanted to see Nicholson human. We still wanted to see traits of this subtle but powerful performance, but it never goes over the top. And that's what really makes this character. The Wolf and Will's character are one, and it never separates. We still feel, even as he's, we have the special effects and the shaky camera or the editing to him even eating a deer, we see Nicholson and we see the mannerisms that he does in an animal state, but it's still Nicholson. It is a very brilliant way to define this character from start to finish.
And cast wise, like, the film has a killer cast. Obviously, Michelle Pfeiffer is bringing an amazing performance. And that's impressive, because the character, I think, is written very shallowly. Like, there isn't a lot to this character on paper. So she brings it in performance. And I'm not saying the two of them have the best chemistry. And in this movie, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because we're not signing up for the romance. We're signing up for, like, the tragedy. And that's kind of what makes it work, is that these two actually shouldn't belong together. They don't work together. And she is, in a sense, damaged goods. She is attracted to animal magnetism, and the magnetism of this animal is dangerous. It's murderous. It's vicious and savage, right? So in a sense, she's almost kind of like putting herself in this bad situation by continuing this relationship. And that's where, like, that obsession part kind of comes in. So like I said, shallow character on paper, but performance-wise, completely fixes that and makes it work. James Spader, man, like, this is a perfect role for him. This is before we get him in Boston Legal. This is before we get him on Blacklist, where he is still kind of playing the sniveling, you know, menacing character. He's really good at that. And in this, it's great, because the way the wolf spirit inhabits him and takes out his greater and darker urges, well, that's an interesting character turn as well for what's really a minor character. You know, turning him into essentially the villain in a movie that doesn't really have a villain, it's just a great way to create conflict and create danger without making it the focal point of the story and pulling away from what journey we're taking with Jack Nicholson. Great casting, and I think a really solid character. Christopher Plummer, you know, perfect in that role. The boss, the rich guy, very powerful and controlling, but also can smell a good deal when he can get it. And really has no loyalties. He essentially plays back and forth between those two characters, and that's what makes him interesting. And not to mention just, you know, the side characters that we always love in seeing movies, David Hyde Pierce, Ron Rifkin, and for a second, David Schwimmer as a cop in the park. That was fun to see.
That was fun to see, and that was right going into his friend's bit. So, but David Hyde Pierce, during my rewatch, I completely forgot he was in this movie. And it's always a pleasure to see David Hyde Pierce in a film. I absolutely love him. But when it comes to James Spader, that is a character that at times, to me, really outshines Nicholson to an extent, because I don't know if it's my love for Spader, but we have a scene in this film where they're at the police station, Pfeiffer's there, and we don't really have that villainous attitude that we should see in a stereotypical movie like this. We get a close-up on the eyes that Pfeiffer zeroes in on, and that's to signify the conflict, the danger of what's to come. And we don't get that kind of shot from Nicholson, because we want to portray the empathy. We want to portray the good guy motif, that he wants to do the right thing. But here we get the shot of just this laser-focused eye on the prize, this deep thought of Spader's eyes, mm-hmm. and it is really compelling and smart direction on Nichols' part to not really add much dialogue, but add the look that this is going to be a different character going into the last act that you're not going to see from Nicholson's character. It's a good, subtle contrast to the good versus evil, and I really, really did like that when it comes to separating again from the monster aspect of it and adding a little bit of depth to the character by smart direction.
Yeah, I mean, the way I looked at it is that we're to assume that Nicholson in his younger days had that drive and that calculating, menacing aggression that Spader had in his youth. And now that he's older, he's lost it. And Spader's in his prime. And the wolf spirit brings that back in Nicholson, but in Spader, it enhances it. you know, let's say he's weaker as a man physically, he's weaker as a man maybe emotionally, but when it comes to the calculation and drive just to get ahead and get whatever he wants, that is what the wolf spirit does that turns him into an evil character. Absolutely fantastic. So we talked about the cast. We talked about the things we like about this movie. We cannot say that there aren't major flaws in this movie. And thank God you mentioned the editing, because it is atrocious. The editing in this movie is atrocious. The pacing is kind of atrocious. The use of cross dissolves and fades makes me want to throw up sometimes. And to me, I'm saying this as a compliment to Nichols and the actors, because if this was any other movie with any other performers, any other script, any other director, the editing would have completely taken me out of the experience. Not to mention the fact that, I mean, come on, were we editing this on a moviola? We are literally putting the stuntman in close-up shots where it's obviously not Jack Nicholson. It's obviously the stuntman with makeup. And we're not doing a long shot on that. We're doing it as a medium or close-up. It still blows my mind. And I have this on Blu-ray HD. It's even worse, because at least back in the VHS days, you could kind of get away with the fuzziness of it. But now that it's crystal clear, I'm like, oh my God, how many shots of the stuntman are they going to show where it's obviously not Jack, but... Whoa, okay, they went with it.
Best viewing experience, watch it on VHS. You can ignore the flaws, so...
100%.
Won't hear that often. But yeah, Sam Osteen, this was, I think, his last movie, if I remember correctly, because there is really nothing after this atrocious editing. But when it comes to how this was missed, and Nichols owns a little bit of this too, is this shouldn't have been missed with how many in volume the editing is so bad that you can't tell me that there isn't a different shot that they could have gone back to. I mean, we have the deer scene where Nicholson's chewing on the deer and there's no blood on his teeth. These are minor things that really kind of take us out of this fantasy of what we're supposed to be being convinced of. So this editing for 94 has to be the worst editing. I shouldn't even give it to a year. I'll say of the decade, because
it's bad.
By the time the credits roll, the most memorable thing of this movie, if it wasn't for the good performances, would be how bad the transitions are, how the editing are, the miss of details. This could have been a really engaging 4-star film if it really wanted to be, if the technical aspects were there. But it is so sloppy, and it will shock me to this day on how all these details were missed.
Yeah, continuity-wise, it is a nightmare. And I'm glad you brought up the deer scene, because that's always bugged me. Even as like a 13-year-old in the theater, it's like, why isn't he bloody? And then it'll cut to his shirt being bloody, but not his face. I'm like, what is going on here? But again, like, there are certain things that you're able to let go. And that being said, you know, the finale, the fight scene between Spader and Jack at the end, it feels very campy, but I don't look at it that way. I look at it as an homage to like the old Universal movies. It feels that way. It's shot that way. It's framed that way. You know, you got the fire in the stable. You got all that stuff going on. That feels very 1940s Universal. So I looked at that as almost an homage to the classics rather than a campy scene that, you know, doesn't really fit the theme of the rest of the movie. There are some interesting choices with the end. I'm not going to give anything away, but it's like, okay, that is a little bit of a stretch for like the twist and the wink, but it still doesn't take away from, to me, this total package. And that's what makes this movie intriguing to me, is because it's hard for me to define this as a horror, and it's hard for me to define it as a drama. It exists in this weird parallel universe where all these different things that shouldn't work together somehow work together in an entertainment fashion, not in a prestige of cinematic accomplishment fashion.
I think we hold onto our seats to the point where we're wondering, is this going to crescendo to more of a romantic? If this is going to crescendo more of a monster movie, where is this movie really going to take us on its journey? And I think that's where a lot of people did have a problem with the ending because we don't really get that answer. Is we're stuck in this purgatory of subgenres of where this movie wants us to kind of just settle, and it never really does. The dust doesn't really settle. We just kind of accept it, because I actually didn't have a problem with the climatic fight scene. I think it looked a little bit more, again, with the editing, like Animorphs, the TV show from the 90s, where you have those jumps where it just goes in slow motion. Then you have the shadow shots. So it looked goofy, where I would have rather just seen Nicholson and Spader just duke it out and call it good.
Yeah.
And that would have been believable, because to me, that would have actually shown and tied together perfectly the aggression, the competitiveness of the workforce nature. And I think a hand-to-hand combat when they're in their animal instincts would have been a very smart move. But again, we have to find that $70 million they spent on this movie to really show some special effects that really didn't work in this movie's favor when it comes to the ending.
Yeah, the wire work of them leaping around is... It's fun, but it's definitely not passable for a solid action scene. And I think I have to compliment Mikkels on that, because he never goes full horror with the horror elements. You know, for example, the guys in Central Park that he takes out, it's a tense moment, but it's not a horror moment. He doesn't go full horror, just like he doesn't go full action. And so kind of existing in that limbo in between genres, I think, is to his best advantage, because he knows what his strong suits are. So by focusing on that and then kind of just, you know, being a little bit more just academic with the other genres, I think is what keeps this movie from going too far one direction or the other and staying in that lane. So, yeah, I think, like I said, as an entertainment piece, I love this movie. I own it. I think it's fantastic. Time to watch. And it does hit different audiences different ways. Like, my mom really likes this movie. My dad didn't like this movie. My partner really likes this movie because she grew up with it with me. But then, like, her sister doesn't. It's a hit and miss. And critically, a lot of critics agreed. And this is one of those weird times before we get into the reviews of our critics where they both kind of agreed and, in my opinion, surprised me with how they favor the film. Especially now that we are, what, almost 50 episodes into this podcast, and we've seen them be very flippant, not only on genre films, but also genre-bending films, which this definitely is.
100%. And one thing that really did surprise me with when we get into it is no real mention of the special effects or anything that we've talked about that is an obvious issue with the movie. So that did take me by surprise, because when you brought this to the table, I wasn't expecting nor did I remember this review. And I was expecting either a split or two thumbs down on it, to be perfectly honest, just because of the things that we've just talked about. So it was a different experience watching these two go at it.
Especially like when we think about the way they had different takes on Fright Night, right? Which is another kind of genre bending horror film, a little bit more gruesome than this one, but I feel like it kind of plays the same notes in a lot of ways. And that's, you know, again, like we see the evolution of their opinions and how they are taking cinema and how they are growing and evolving with how cinema was changing, especially in the 90s. Once again, here's a 1994 film that we keep talking about that they had a very different opinion about 1994 films than they did in the decade before. And I think that we're going to really get into that more in season two, especially when we do a Pulp Fiction episode, because I feel like that was the thing that changed their view on what cinema, I'm not going to say should be, but could be, and what they were going to allow filmmakers to do and what they were going to say in their critiques. As apart from all the things that they said in the 70s and 80s, they were holding cinema to a different standard. And I feel like their review of this film is definitely one of the earlier examples of that. So with that, let's just jump into their critiques. This was Roger's film to bring to the table.
Jack Nicholson plays a New York book editor there who's awakened by his wife after sleeping all day long. And that's one of the first hints that Nicholson is turning into a werewolf with nocturnal habits after being bitten by a wolf by the light, needless to say, of the full moon a few days earlier. And the new Mike Nichols film Wolf takes that idea as a starting point for an offbeat werewolf film that asks what would happen if an intelligent, sensitive, literate man suddenly found himself filled with savage instincts. The movie uses realistic everyday dialogue to try to make the story seem creepier because it's surrounded by the ordinary.
I think that his synopsis really nails the point down where this is a film about a simple, sensitive man. What would happen if aggression took over? But also the writing, the script, where this isn't an ominous script. There aren't really ominous moments. It really is, in a sense, a drama about a man facing all these challenges with his job and his marriage. And the wolf part is literally just a sidestep into this story of how it's going to change his life. Because even after he's bitten by the wolf and he becomes a stronger, more macho and confident man, he directs that all into his job, his career, and getting back at his wife. It's really that we're focusing on, not the horror element, not the supernatural element. That's just kind of like confetti that we sprinkle on this story. We're really looking at a guy going through his midlife crisis and all these challenges with his being middle-aged. It's fascinating that not only do we have the film play this way, but Roger notices it right away and makes that comparison just in the synopsis of the film.
The key piece of that synopsis is the ordinary working around the characters. And I love that because that's exactly it. Is we have this not over the top procession, but a unique profession. And we have a line delivered in this film where Nicholson spouts that regarding his age, that he's too old or it's too late for him, whatever it may be. And we see that in a relatability factor with a lot of characters and a lot of movies that we see today. So to me, that's what really makes it is the ordinary. When you need that ordinary, you have to have the relatability, and that's what it is. We see that progression of the characters in the beginning where Nicholson's trying to figure out a plan of, oh, if I get fired, what am I going to do? That is right. Something completely ordinary. And I love that he recognized the environment of which we're in this movie is these are situations that don't go cliche. They are relatable. And it is another conflict that the plot is going to have to bounce off of. So that is, again, one of the most recognizable pieces of it that I think is easily missed with this. And I'm glad Roger nailed it on it.
Well, I'm a sucker for an everyday guy discovering something new about himself. Just like, you know, in Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, where he starts realizing he's got spider senses, or even like in Liar Liar, where he realizes he can't lie and all the things that happened throughout his day that were once routine are now challenging. They have that in this movie. And it's almost like the funniest part of the movie where now he can smell if his coworkers have been drinking. He can hear people having sex across the street. Like he can have all these heightened senses. And it brings like a kind of joyfulness to the movie for what's normally a dark thing. It's like we're almost kind of cheering him on for being a little bit more in tune with his surroundings and with his instincts. It's a really great way to get us to like this character. It's almost like we're cheering him on for becoming a werewolf because we didn't like the guy he was before.
I think Nichols and Nicholson have tried something interesting here, a literate werewolf story, sort of like what Anne Rice does for vampires. But there were a couple of things I missed. In the very similar movie The Fly, where a man fell in love with a woman while turning into an insect, there was more poignancy and also more passion than in this story. This time, the story is told more in terms of words and ideas. I know they didn't want to make a melodramatic horror film here, but they almost went too far in the other direction. Still, Wolf did get me involved, and I vote thumbs up.
Another interesting piece that he puts there because, yeah, comparing it to Fly, I think, is somewhat correct in the terms of the tone of the movie. I mean, it's nowhere near as grotesque. But also, The Fly is a tragic romance movie, and I don't feel this movie is that. There is tragedy with the romance, but I don't think we're ever supposed to be led to believe that this is 100% a romance movie. If anything, he would have never been connected with Michelle Pfeiffer, attracted to her, or her attracted to him, had the wolf not bit him and his instincts have changed. That is kind of like the point of the story where he's a nobody. And she's the daughter of a rich dude, and she even treats him like a nobody at first. And it's as the time goes on and the instincts change, who knows, maybe there's even pheromones at play that's in the subtext. That is a very a strong way to get us to be related to these characters. But at the same time, it's not a romance story. I think he says that he misses that. I don't. I think it's fine because it really is just another anchor of character development for Jack Nicholson and Michelle Pfeiffer's characters.
I can see where he's going with the Fly comparison. Me, I don't see it because, one, we look at the Fly, the chemistry. These are two that really did like each other. They really did have that chemistry. They really did want to be together in a stance. But here, it's almost passion driven. It's an animal instinct where we don't get that chemistry. We don't get that we need to be together. There's no lines of dialogue that say the ending's going to end with these two running off in the sunset. And you're absolutely right. The Fly is a tragedy, but here, this is like two people that both have internal conflicts that find each other based on their individuality and or their animal instincts that drive them together. And we see examples of this in the form of passion, the form of danger. So there is nothing here that spouts romance, right. Love. It's all passion. And that is the core foundation of the animal instinct that Nichols is trying to portray here. So to me, I think it's kind of an unfair comparison because The Fly is a monster movie. You have a male and female that have this chemistry, this relationship. That's not what we have here. This is a kind of going off in a different direction. And I think the balance based on passion is equally fair here.
Yeah, because it is challenging to write a story about characters who are lost emotionally and be able to connect with them. I mean, the whole reason why she even has any interest in him at first is just to piss her dad off, right? That's how her attraction to him begins. And with her, it's like, okay, you're the boss's daughter. My wife is cheating on me with James Spader, blee, blue, blah. And my new animal instincts are just drawing to me you because you are Michelle Pfeiffer and you're gorgeous. It's not built on anything but a circumstantial infatuation. And I like that because it doesn't make that like the make or break part of the story, but it gives us a satisfying finale, so to speak, because they do have a connection, but it's not the romantic connection that we were talking about in The Fly, where these are people that are torn apart due to science, due to tragedy. It's a very different tone on that. I agree.
Well, I liked it a little bit more than you then, I guess. And I do agree that the weakness is between the relationship between the way it's played out between Nicholson and Pfeiffer. Yeah. In fact, I think the film's biggest weakness is the ending of the picture. Mm-hmm. It just sort of runs out in a very predictable way.
Yes, it does.
And unsatisfying. But before we get to that, you put your finger on the strength of the film as well, which is that it is smart characters having this happen to them. And that's really good because then we can relate to what it would be like if this were going on in our presence. And of course, this is the kind of role that Nicholson can do
Nicholson.
Well. I mean, it's great cast. You know you're going to be entertained when you hear what he's being cast
as.
Yeah,
Nicholson is perfect for this role. And I got in touch with the fact as I was watching the movie that so often in werewolf movies and in horror movies in general, the people in the movie never seem to know what's happening to them. And you ask yourself, well, don't they watch The Late Show? I mean, haven't they ever seen any movies about this? Obviously, Nicholson's character knows exactly what's happening to him.
You see it.
And
his self-awareness
leads to some of the best dialogue in the movie.
And the reason that I was disappointed with the ending is because there's a great opening scene between Pfeiffer and Nicholson where she first meets him. And remember, she's sort of disdainful of this older guy coming on to her. But then she gets attracted to him. And just the way she pats his jacket, when people see this, the film, it's a real fine little piece of acting.
So there needs to be a better payoff.
You got it.
So, yeah, I think Gene has the same mentality that I do. And it's really refreshing to see them agree on a film, especially when it's one that I enjoy as well and you enjoy as well, yet so many other critics tore apart. And I think they just didn't understand what Mike Nichols was trying to do with this film, and they get it. This was a thinking man's monster movie. It wasn't played for horror. It wasn't played for thrills and scares. It was literally taking, like he said, smart, intelligent, literate people and putting them in a horror film situation, but not letting itself delve into horror. And we don't see a lot of that. I think the marketing was bad, like we said, but at the end of the day, this really is a very intelligent script, and I really do feel that most of its drawbacks are the fact that we aren't dealing with people who are used to making horror films, used to making horror scenes. It doesn't take away from the film. Instead, it creates this weird kind of like contradiction of horror slash drama, and it just makes it different. And I think that's why they liked it so much and didn't have the arguments like they had over Fright Night, because this wasn't trying to be a genre-bending horror film. This was trying to be a genre-bending dramatic film. And we don't see a lot of those.
And this is where, based on what Gene said, it really brings out the cynical side of me when it comes to it. And we've had this conversation before of going in with the marketing, being presented something different from the trailers, going into the movie and getting something completely different. They've had this issue before and they are being delivered something different. It almost makes me wonder if I were to assume, being the cynical man that I am, if Nicholson, Pfeiffer, or even Spader were not cast in the roles, because they amplified in this conversation Nicholson. Nicholson was perfect for this role. Nicholson, you know you're in for a good time. If Nicholson didn't have this role, would they have had the same input on this movie? And that would be right. A big assumption of, does the cast really impact a film to really change your perception of what you were promised going into it? So I think that is a big speaking point to when it comes to film criticism, especially with these two that have had time over time of issues walking in expecting something different.
One of the things that this film probably doesn't get as much credit for than it should is the fact that this, like we said, is a very different Jack Nicholson performance. And so when they said, oh, well, you put Jack Nicholson, he's perfect for it. Is he? I thought that this was a very different type of character for him to play. Even when he is in the werewolf makeup, it doesn't feel natural. And I think that's what adds to the movie. Like, he does seem out of place wearing prosthetics, wearing fangs, wearing fur on his face. I mean, he is so famous for his face and his expression and his attitude. And this movie covers it up a lot in those scenes. So it is, to me, a very refreshing, different take of his performance, of his style. And so that is where I do suggest this movie to people, not as a horror movie, but it's like, dude, you need to see Jack Nicholson in this movie. He's doing something very different. He's on a whole different level. And if you've seen all of his movies from the 90s and his 2000s, I mean, as good as it gets was like, what, 2 or 3 years after this? Yeah, he won Best Actor for that movie, but that was just him with OCD, right? There are just so many Jack Nicholson movies where it's just him with OCD, or him with an addiction, or him with violence or obsession, and this is completely different. So I would say the curio of this movie is that performance, and whether or not you feel that you're a horror fan, or if you're a fan of drama or genre-bending films, just seeing Nicholson out of his element is worth the price of admission for me.
Nicholson had an idea of this portrayal, and it is a good performance. And even with prosthetics, I think they were smart pulling back on a lot of the special effects to let Nicholson's facial expressions really guide this.
Not going full American Werewolf in London with it.
Yeah, you're not going to hire Nicholson as a werewolf and say, cover the face in all fur, because you're going to utilize the talent that he has of his facial expressions. And he does utilize it. But what I appreciated about this performance is that he doesn't go overboard. He uses the prosthetics as a complement to his facial expressions. And that is what I really wish that Nichols would have really utilized a little bit more of, to really show what Nichols can do on his range, even in prosthetics. We had him in Batman in 89 with the Joker, but that one still showed full length of what he can do with his facial expressions. Here, you have bits and pieces of fur covering aspects of his face, and he's still able to utilize it in a believable way that doesn't feel necessarily full danger, but it's a good balance between danger and empathy. And not a lot of performances, you can see that, especially with CGI and special effects, even in the 90s, that can really complement a performance as Nicholson does here. So it is one that I almost, dare I say, wish he did more of, because he is one of those rare talents that can really use it to his advantage.
I also think that there is something quite fascinating about watching him run. Because I have a hard time trying to recall any film where I've seen Jack Nicholson run. Granted, it's in slow motion, like it's overcranked, but seeing him run is such an interesting thing. It's like seeing a fish walk on land. And I love it. I love seeing just these different sides of him. And also I love the fact that even though he is a werewolf, he's still wearing like his blue shirt and cotton Dockers, right? It's just something so perfect about that portrayal of a werewolf and how he does it in this movie, where it's just like, yeah, I can honestly, I don't want to see Jack Nicholson in a full fur bodysuit. Let him wear his cotton Dockers and his hush puppies and just put fur on his face and fangs, and I'm totally in.
I love those subtle things in it. And again, we've gone the whole show without talking about the pee scene. And that is one of my favorite scenes because it's the best transition to show Animal and Will's character just kind of unite as one, is just peeing on James Spader's suede shoes. And it is a very great scene that really transitions this into kind of more the animal instinct. So it is a brilliant scene, and it is my favorite scene.
Yeah, it's a great scene. I can't believe I didn't bring it up first. Damn you. So yeah. So like I said, this is a refreshing episode because I don't really disagree with anything that either of these critics say. They champion the movies. And just like me, they have their issues, but they don't let the issues take away from the overall entertainment of this movie. I feel like too many times my boy Gene will let the smallest detail ruin a film for him. And on the flip side, he will let the smallest detail make a bad movie work for him. It's a double-edged sword with him. The fact that the redemption piece of Blame It on Rio was enough to save the movie for him, or the fact that he didn't like the language or the violence of another film and let a good film be a thumbs down for him. This movie just is like sat right in his wheelhouse. The review works for me. So that being said, at the end of the day, I'm giving him a B+. I like it.
Yeah. And same goes with Roger. I think he kind of nailed the exact feelings that we felt watching this movie. Is it's not full blown horror. He acknowledges the intelligent writing, the atmosphere, the setting, the situational aspects of these characters that they're in. So there is a lot more to this movie than just a wolf or it going full horror. And I loved the fact that he brought that up in his first initial piece of it, is that sets the expectation of what to expect than what we got from the marketing. And it's rare that we'll have a critic say, this is a smart horror movie, because he doesn't even use the word horror on it. It's smart writing. It's smart, more of the fantasy elm of it. So even in his written review, he had issues with the budget. He had issues with a lot of the where did the money go? And I think this one's obvious. It's the cast. But that doesn't take away from the movie. Here is where the money went well spent, because the cast actually does work here and they work extremely well. They earn their paycheck in this one. So Roger, if I had to give it, I think it's a solid 3 stars, only because I'm disappointed they didn't bring up the main flaws of the movie. That is so obviously apparent that it's hard to miss. And it does take us out of the movie a little bit because it happens so much. So that's my only disappointment with this review.
And I'd love to just kind of echo on that, is that the flaws in this movie are what are always spoken about when people say this is a bad movie. You know, if you watch like the Collider videos or the Mojo videos on YouTube of like the worst horror movies ever made or questionable movies, this one pops up on there all the time. And they use all the things that we just talked about as the examples. The makeup, the inconsistency of continuity, the wire work at the end. You know, James Spader, his makeup is questionable, right? I like it, but if you're comparing it to other horror movies, yes, you are going to be disappointed. And I think that is the problem. Marketing this movie, calling it a horror movie, I have it in the drama section of my movies. I don't have it in horror because it's not a horror movie, in my opinion. And I think that is the biggest detriment of how it's marketed and how it's packaged. If we didn't look at it as a horror movie as a society, I think it would have a much better legacy and a much better opinion in the cinematic community than it does, simply because it was so severely mismarketed.
100%, because this, what I'm with you, this is a drama slash fantasy, and I think this one surprises me that it hasn't been brought to the table more when it comes to analyzing the themes, because we get the director's themes, we get the writer's themes of what their intent was, but there is so much more that you can take from this movie of interpretation that it's just not clear of what the intent is. So there are so many symbolic pieces of this from what we've just talked about that can really add value to how you see this movie, if you don't see it as a horror movie, because once you put it in that realm, you're not going to take value from it, because you set that mentally set that expectation up of disappointment, because messaging belongs in a lot of these movies where you actually do take value. And I think when you put the fantasy term on it, that's where you're going to set the expectation of taking something of value away from this film.
Oh, agreed, 100%. And just because I think it's fun, this is the second movie where Michelle Pfeiffer falls in love with a man who turns into a wolf. I'm talking about Lady Hawk. Guilty pleasure of mine. That might end up on season two.
It's funny. I knew Lady Hawk was going to come up somewhere in this conversation.
It was going to be me. It was going to be me that brought it up. One of my favorite soundtracks of the 80s, too. It's terrible. All right. So next week, we are really just kind of jumping into the holiday season now. Thanksgiving, then Christmas, and then our New Year's special. So Justin is bringing to the show, I think, a very underrated, underseen Thanksgiving-themed film. He's bringing Dutch to the podcast. I'm really excited about this because I think it lines up perfectly with my pick for the following week, which we'll get to. But yeah, I'm excited to rewatch this. This is a perennial favorite for me. I always watch it during Thanksgiving, but I don't think I've ever talked about it nor heard it talked about on a podcast. So this is going to be cool.
Super excited. Ed O'Neill, we didn't see enough in movies, and I think this one's going to be a good conversational piece because I think it's complete. Well, I shouldn't give it away, but it is completely underrated.
Completely underrated. All right, so I'm looking forward to that. So everyone, thank you for watching, listening. Please like, review, rate, subscribe, give us 5 stars on Apple, on Spotify, on YouTube. You can find me, Antonio, and all my other stuff on thecultworthy.com. Same on the socials under The Cultworthy, and you can find my friend Justin over at
themoviewire.com.
And as we're getting into this new year, I'm going to say once again, please send us your suggestions. We've got a lot of slots to fill, and we want to fill them with things that you want to hear us talk about. So if it was a film that Siskel and Ebert talked about on their show, let us know what it is, and we will put it on the list and give you a special shout out for doing so. It's a pleasure, Justin. I'll see you next week.
See you next week.